Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The new plan to preserve the nation's wetlands is receiving a mixed review. However, most agree it's better than having no plan at all. Meanwhile, the death or the resurrection of an entire ecosystem is in our hands, says Florida Bay fishing guide Hank Brown.
I look at Florida Bay today, and I simply want to cry, literally, because I know what it was, and when I drift over grass beds like this morning when we were bone fishing, that are still healthy grass beds, and remember that only a short time ago, all of Florida Bay was the same way.
A very special report from Joseph Cooper, next on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Referring to the new wetlands policy recently released by the White House, Kathleen McGinty, director of the Office on Environmental Policy, says, quote, "This plan is balanced and fair," end quote. Though the policy is not without its critics, most agree there is balance and fairness, at least more so than with any plan to date. The reaction of National Wildlife Federation attorney Jan Goldman Carter is characteristic of the mixed review.
Well, the reaction of the National Wildlife Federation has been one of disappointment. There are obviously some very important steps forward in this package, and one of those is the one that stems from the litigation, which closes a major loophole for the ditching and draining of wetlands, which previously had not been consistently regulated by the Corps. The concerns we have are some potentially very large loopholes that relate to agricultural lands and also to an increased role for state and local governments in regulating wetlands around the country.
The Corps Carter refers to is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the litigation she mentions was a suit she helped bring against the Corps involving a situation in North Carolina, where, during the Bush administration, the Corps first allowed a tract of coastal wetland to be drained and then withdrew its wetland status. At the center of this debate is the lack of consensus or formal definition of what a wetland is. Most famous was the statement by then-Vice President Quayle that, to wit, a land is a wetland if it is wet. This overlooked that some land is visibly dry during certain times of the year, though it functions as a wetland during other times. Carter is pleased to say the new proposed Clinton wetland policy specifically prohibits the kind of activity the Corps engaged in North Carolina. However, Carter says the new plan does not go far enough on other issues.
Other provisions which we're very concerned about, which also came out of the Bush years, are the emphasis on wetland ranking, basically ordering wetlands from high to low value and then providing minimal regulation for the wetlands deemed to be of low value, and also mitigation banking, which is a nifty way to allow developers to destroy natural wetlands with the somewhat risky proposition of recreating them in another location.
Dean Kleckner, president of the American Farm Bureau, is pleased overall with the new plan. Kleckner is relieved to see the plan does not touch prior converted wetland.
In other words, wetlands that maybe used to be wet or land that was wet, even if it wasn't an official wetland, if it was converted into use or drained in recent years, in other words, prior to 1985, it's exempt from these regulations. We like that.
Some 54 million acres of wetland drained for cropland will be allowed to remain cropland. Kleckner is also pleased to see that the Soil Conservation Service will have oversight.
We just think that SCS has a long history dealing with farmers, dealing with soils, dealing with conservation. They're the logical entity to do that. Now, there's a little bit of a concern that we still have because the other three agencies, which are EPA, Fish and Wildlife, and the Corps of Engineers, still have apparently some oversight with USDA, and that's been the problem all along, that farmers haven't known which agency to deal with. Sometimes they've asked a question and with four agencies gotten four different answers. So while we like the fact that soil conservation will be the agency to determine and identify, define wetlands, where possibly the other agencies with the oversight will take a an inch and make it into a mile, and we'll have the farmer still not knowing what the answers are when they ask someone, is this a wetland or isn't it?
Kleckner stresses his belief that farmers are willing to restore wetlands and to refrain from destroying what already exists. His chief concern is to see these policies become law and not left just to regulation.
We've been around long enough to know that that regulations can change. We kind of like what the administration is doing now, but perhaps later in the Clinton administration or a new administration or new people coming in can simply, by the stroke of a pen, reverse things if it's in law. And there's a bill introduced by Congressman Jimmy Hayes of Louisiana, a Democrat, H.R. 1330, that we're strongly in support of. It has a good many sponsors right now. So we'd like to see, in effect, these regulations that they just announced codified or put into law.
Robin Marks is a water quality specialist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She calls the new plan a mixed bag. Though pleased to see protection extended to Alaskan wetlands, something we haven't mentioned yet here, she says the NRDC does not like to see the Clinton administration turning away from a federalist stance here.
We're concerned about the increase in the authority of state and local governments to run the federal wetlands program. We think that that may occur without the full safeguards required by the Clean Water Act.
Why would you, I've heard that expressed before by others, that turning it to the state and local level opens the policy to more and potentially damaging negotiations. But why is that? Why is there such a, why would there be a difference in policing, so to speak, from the federal level to the state level?
Well, first of all, a lot of states haven't taken over the authority, even though they've had the option of doing so for some time, because they are not sure themselves that they have the expertise. We're also concerned about the local political pressure that will come to bear if state authorities are given that option of delineating wetlands.
In other words, the concern here is that special interests may work their powers for compromise and amendment more easily at the state level than on Capitol Hill. She also believes the federal agencies designing wetlands protection strategies are more skilled at their work than would be a comparable state agency, if only because the federal agencies have been at it for longer and have been operating with the national view in mind. Taken as a whole, the wetlands document, says Marks, should be seen as a political maneuver.
This policy doesn't satisfy anyone, really. It attempts to to make everyone feel as though they've got something and they're giving up something. So I think that the policy was crafted so that nobody will be completely satisfied, which I think is unfortunate, because I think that there was the opportunity to really, down the line, to provide some strengthening amendments. And this has done it to a certain extent, but there's a ways to go on that.
The whole issue turns on what is a wetland. The American Farm Bureau's Dean Kleckner mentioned the bill by Louisiana Congressman Jimmy Hayes. Contained in that bill is an elaborate definition of the various types of wetlands. There have been other attempts to place the wording of a definition within political terminology. Senators Boxer of California, Baucus of Montana, and Chafee of Rhode Island, for example, are also crafting legislation. However, the National Academy of Sciences has now been given the charge to come up with a scientific definition, one that will be used to inform any future legislation. That report is due out later this year and will become part of the work to reauthorize the Clean Water Act, one part of which is protection of wetlands. However, in following the argument constructed by Kleckner, we see that already there is controversy over what that scientific definition will be.
We're very concerned about the National Academy of Sciences' review of this. We think the people that are doing it, and it's been publicly announced who they are, it's overloaded with academia. There is virtually no, or there is no, a farmer representation on it. There's very little even farm academia representation on it. And it's going to be an 18-month study. We were opposed, honestly, frankly, to having the National Academy of Sciences do the study. We said there's been enough study. Things are known about wetlands. Very often studies, to be honest, are only voted to delay things. If Congress doesn't want to make a decision, it's easy to vote $500,000 or $1.5 million or $5 million to do a study. That means they put off making a decision for a year, 18 months, 2 years. This is going to be, if I remember correctly, an 18-month study. I don't remember if it was $500,000 or $1 million. For heaven's sakes, it's a waste of taxpayers' money. We know these things. And then when I look at who's on the committee, I am even more perturbed about what may result from this committee study.
Dean Kleckner, president of the American Farm Bureau. We also heard from Robin Marks, water quality specialist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Jan Goldman Carter, an attorney representing the National Wildlife Federation. Concerning the fate of the new policy, to paraphrase Mr. Abraham Lincoln, you can't please all of the people all of the time. In politics, the reasonable mark to hit is to please some of the people some of the time. This is Bruce Robertson. At harvest time, you gather your pruning shears, your baskets, your canning jars, and your microwave oven. Your microwave oven? Well, that's what we said, too, when we heard this from Larry Somke, the environmental gardener. The microwave has become part of his fall harvest scene. He's anxious to show us. If you're skeptical, so are we. Let's find out.
How you doing, Larry?
Well, hi, Bruce. What's going on?
Well, I remember earlier this summer, a while back, you were planting your herb garden. What are you doing in the herb garden now?
Well, now that the herbs are all up and growing, it's time to harvest them, and I'm going to dry them. But, you know, there's another more modern way to dry herbs, which I've just discovered in the last couple years.
Somehow I knew you'd have a more modern way.
The quick and easy way, and actually what we're going to do is go on into the kitchen now, and I'll show you that you can dry herbs in the microwave. And it's pretty modern, and it's pretty quick, and it works really well. Now, besides mint, other herbs that dry really well are thyme, and anise hyssop, and borage, and strawberries. Those all make great tea and potpourri. But you can also, basil. I always do some basil. Every year I dry basil, and then I have basil in it. Now, here we are at
at the microwave.
So you just take it's just an ordinary microwave, and you probably should read your book, your microwave book, before you do anything, because all microwaves are different. And you should just put a layer of paper towel in the bottom of the, in there. Put a nice handful of, I have about like 2 or 3 cups of herbs in there. Then cover those up with some another paper towel, and then just turn this...
No, dry paper towel, not moist, right?
Dry paper towel, and the herbs should be dry. If you want to wash them first, go ahead and do that, but make sure they're dry before you put them in there.
Okay.
I don't wash them because everything is real nice and clean where I am. And so you just turn the microwave on for a couple minutes, and it really comes out really well. I've got some here that I did earlier today in the microwave. This is a nice mint, and you see it's nice and crackly. It has a real good fragrance. And this and it keeps its nice green color really well.
Yep.
And so now, you know, if you're in a hurry, you can have nice dried herbs in the microwave, or you can go ahead and do it the old-fashioned way and cut them, tie a little string around the bottom of them or a rubber band, hang them up in the garage, and in just a matter of days, you'll have herbs.
All right, and we're partially through here.
Here
they
come.
Let's take a check.
See, here they come out. And you can see already they're nice and dry, and they're fragrant. And whenever you take things out of the microwave, let them cool down before you make a decision.
And if they're not dried enough, can you put them back in?
Yes, you can. Just keep putting them in for another 15 or 20 seconds until they're just right. But let them cool down before you make a decision on that, because they will become a little more brittle as they cool down. So you can see some of the oils are here, and they really have a nice fragrance.
Yes. Mm.
So you can make some nice Middle Eastern food or make some nice herb tea.
Delicious.
And so you can either dry it the old-fashioned way or dry it the modern way, whatever way you like it, you'll get some great herbs out of it.
Well, that sounds good. Larry, I'll leave it to you, the modern environmental gardener with his microwave in the kitchen. We'll see you next time, Larry.
All right, come by anytime.
Certainly. Bye-bye now.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His herbs and microwave are part of the harvest scene in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Florida Bay is the warm, shallow body of water at the very tip of the Florida Peninsula. The upper part of Florida Bay lies within the boundaries of Everglades National Park. The lower part extends to the Florida Keys. Experts say the health of Florida Bay is linked to the wetland ecosystem of the Florida Everglades. They say the natural slow flow of clean water must be restored. The cleanup and restoration of the Everglades system has been an ongoing legal battle between state and federal governments, the Florida sugar industry, and environmentalists. While those parties debate the issues of the Everglades, huge portions of Florida Bay lie under a cloud of suffocating algae. The once sparkling water that teemed with sea life is now opaque and pea green. From Isla Mirada in the Florida Keys, Joseph Cooper has more.
The Florida Keys begin just 50 miles south of downtown Miami. U.S. Highway 1 carries an endless stream of traffic through this tiny island chain that includes the magnificent Overseas Highway and 7-mile bridge. The road ends in colorful Key West, where the fishing was so good that Ernest Hemingway became the town's best-known resident. Florida Bay, and the only living coral reef in the United States, is everything to the economy of the Florida Keys. It's the attraction for tourists who come to fish and dive. It also supports a large commercial fishing industry. Keys fishing guide Hank Brown ties up his small boat at the Lorelei.
I look at Florida Bay today, and I simply want to cry, literally, because I know what it was, and when I drift over grass beds like this morning when we were bone fishing, that are still healthy grass beds, and remember that only a short time ago, all of Florida Bay was the same way. You had a beautiful area to fish in, and there was such a variety of fish, from redfish to sheepshead to tarpon to permit to bonefish to cobia. I mean, it was an endless supply of fish, to the point where all of us thought this was never going to end.
Humans have influenced Florida Bay by building a system of dikes and canals that manage the water in southern Florida. The natural slow flow of fresh water through the Everglades from Lake Okeechobee that eventually found its way to Florida Bay no longer exists. Farming and urban demands, as well as flood control, requires the water to be diverted from the Everglades system. Efforts are underway to artificially mimic the natural water flow, but radical changes require agreement between the Army Corps of Engineers, the South Florida Water Management District, and agriculture interests. There have been lawsuits, settlements, more suits, studies, panels, and committees, but none have reversed the decline of Florida Bay waters.
Florida Bay is a huge, very shallow, tropical, subtropical lagoon located below the mainland Florida, behind the Florida Keys.
Mike Robley is a marine research ecologist at Everglades National Park. He says the problems of the bay were first noticed about 6 years ago, on the bottom of the bay, where miles of seagrasses have died off.
We have referred to areas of really severe seagrass die-off as dead zones. All grass died. And we had this, what had once been a lush seagrass bed, carpet of grass for miles, would just be this bare mud bottom.
Robley's best guess is that there's more than just one reason why the seagrass began to die. First, higher than average water salinities stressed the plants. Some high salinity can be blamed on man for reducing the natural flow of water from the Everglades into the bay over the years. Salinity was also elevated by droughts in the late 1980s. Perhaps the stressed seagrass plants were attacked by a disease. Researchers are working on that. Nonetheless, when the grasses die and decompose, they cloud the water with nutrients and degrade photosynthesis. Oxygen is then reduced, causing more grass to die. Then comes the algal blooms.
In my view at this point, Florida Bay's got good water quality. There's very little indication that farm effluent is coming in overland. I have no doubt that in the long term, Florida Bay will recover. We've never been closer to fixing it than we are these days. And it's just a matter of, at this point, it's a matter of money and some willpower.
Captain Mike Collins is a backcountry fishing guide out of Isla Mirada in the Middle Keys. Today he's taking us on a tour of the Florida Bay algae bloom with his young son aboard. Collins, in his early 40s, has fished the bay for 20 years and seen its rapid decline.
Even this water in here, which is still relatively clear, I mean, you can see the bottom and all, is discolored to a degree by these algae blooms. If you look at it, that sort of gray-green sort of shade to it really isn't natural. You see what I'm talking about? Can you see the color change we just went through? We just hit that tide line where the bay drains. We just went from visibility where we could see the bottom in 10 feet of water, and it'll start getting worse here. We're in a situation where we're in 6 feet of water now, and I can't see the bottom. We're just getting on the edge of it now. Dirty pea soup sort of green. Real reduction in visibility. We used to run across the bay years ago. Middle part of the bay this time of year when it slicked off. What the experience was marked by, other than, you know, cascading showers of bait fish, were just waves of shrimp sort of popping and jumping out of your path. Juvenile, you know, pink shrimp and white shrimp. And since this bloom showed up, I haven't seen a single one back in there. You know, you run back there when it's slick calm and all you see now is just mud. Let's see if we can get a little deeper into this.
Collins knows the bay like the back of his hand and is sensitive to the subtle changes in the water.
Gone from water where we had, you could see the bottom in 8 or 10 feet, to water where you could sort of see something at 6 feet. Now we're in 3 feet, and I can't even see anything in this. There are places in the interior of the bay where the visibility is less than 6 inches. I'm not going to run back there. It makes me cry when I want to cry when I do. And there's sort of being another one of the inline predators in here. I'm not feeling real good about that. There.
What are you looking for?
Sargassum weed is where all the juvenile shrimp come in. They're spawned out in open water. They drift in this sargassum weed. Usually you can pick up a clump of this and shake out about 50 little, 2-3 centimeter long shrimp. Let's see if I can find any in this stuff. No. Those aren't shrimp. There's one. There we are. There's two of them. All right, we found two. Well, this is where they're supposed to be. There sure should be a lot more than two in a clump of weed that size. These are snapping shrimp. Very basic sort of part of this whole food chain. This is just the fringes of this bloom. This, you know, cyanic bloom has places, like I said, in the interior of Florida Bay where, you know, the visibility is seriously less than 6 inches. Traditionally, visibility this time of year in Keys water would be 60 to 80 feet. Scary. I think we're basically kind of out of time. Our government's going to hem and haw and, you know, sit on their hands, you know, just a little bit longer. I'll be real lucky if he ever sees, you know, any of the effects of an eventual Everglades restoration, and I sure won't be around to see it.
The plight of Florida Bay is now in the hands of an eminent group of scientists who were commissioned by Everglades National Park and the South Florida Water Management District. Their mammoth task is to interpret the data of many scientists and give answers to what can be done to reverse the expanding dead zone in the bay. It may take a large-scale public works project over many years to revamp the system of canals and dikes which divert water from the Everglades. The panel's report is due in October. Meanwhile, those in Florida hope Florida Bay will again be the bountiful and beautiful body of water that helped make the Keys the sports fishing capital of the world. In Isla Mirada, this is Joseph Cooper.
That's our report on the Environment Show this week. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, 193. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.